Proverbs 10:12, hatred stirs up quarrels, but love makes up for all offenses. 13:10, pride leads to conflict. Those who take advice are wise. 14:9-10, fools make fun of guilt, but the godly acknowledge it and seek reconciliation. Each heart knows its own bitterness, and no one else can fully share its joy. 17:1, better a dry crust eaten in peace than a house filled with feasting and conflict. 17:9, love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends. 18:19, an offended friend is harder to win back than a fortified city. Arguments separate friends like a gate locked with bars. 23, avoiding a fight is a mark of honor. Only fools insist on quarreling. 21:9, it's better to live alone in the corner of an attic than with a quarrelsome wife in a lovely home. 22:10, throw out the mocker, and fighting goes too. Quarrels and insults will disappear. 22:24-25, don't befriend angry people or associate with hot-tempered people, or you will learn to be like them and endanger your soul. 25:21-22, if your enemies are hungry, give them food to eat. If they are thirsty, give them water to drink. You will heap burning coals of shame on their heads, and the Lord will reward you. 26:20-26, fire goes out without wood, and a quarrel disappears when gossip stops. A quarrelsome person starts fights as easily as hot embers light charcoal or fire lights wood. Rumors are dainty morsels that sink deep into one's heart. Smooth words may hide a wicked heart, just as a pretty glaze covers a clay pot. People may cover their hatred with pleasant words, but they're deceiving you. They pretend to be kind, but don't believe them. Their hearts are full of many evils, while their hatred may be concealed by trickery. Their wrongdoing will be exposed in public. 27:3, a stone is heavy and sand is weighty, but the resentment caused by a fool is even heavier. 27:15-16, a quarrelsome wife is as annoying as constant dripping on a rainy day. Stopping her complaints is like trying to stop the wind or trying to hold something with greased hands. 28:13-14, people who conceal their sins will not prosper, but if they confess and turn from them, they will receive mercy. Blessed are those who fear to do wrong, but the stubborn are headed for serious trouble. 28:25, greed causes fighting. Trusting the Lord leads to prosperity. This is God's word.
All right, that's quite a list. So may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight. O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. As you know, we're looking at wisdom literature, and we tried to map it out according to the historic church calendar, which I keep forgetting to say. So we're in a time called ordinary time, and whenever we're in ordinary time in the calendar, we're doing Proverbs on various topics that were presented by people in the church. And today's topic is reconciliation, and I didn't really get a lot of info on what about reconciliation, but I assume there's a desire to seek wisdom on how to do it, how to think about it, maybe even how to proceed if it seems like it isn't happening. And so that's our topic for the evening. And these were the proverbs I found that seemed to hint around reconciliation or what gets in the way of it. So I assume living in the times that we do among humans, as we do in communities, as we do, that even as I bring up this topic, each and every one of you probably already has a situation in your mind that's percolating, right? If you're lucky, it's one where reconciliation happened and it's the most beautiful story in the world and you love it. If you're typical, it's one where, you know, we tend to have the bad memories show up first and we might be thinking about when it hasn't happened. for some of us, it's ones that seem really like there's nothing that can be done. I mean, everything from like it's been tried and tried to the person isn't here. They've died. Whatever the case, I'd be surprised, because I'm one of you, if we didn't have those kind of things coming to mind. As soon as I saw the topic on the page, I had several situations just rise up to the top of my mind. So here's what I want you to do with those situations. I want you to go ahead and think about them because they're relevant. It's real. And that's what happens when we think about this topic. You don't have to try to fight thinking about it. Just go ahead and hold that situation for a moment. And we'll actually come back to it a little bit later. And I want to ask you a question about how you're feeling if you have one of those situations coming up in your mind. I'm having trouble with my slide. There it goes. Okay. If you've successfully thought of a situation that deals with reconciliation, here's an emotional color wheel you probably can't read. But what feelings come up when you think about that situation? Don't name the situation. Just give me a feeling. What do you... Anxiety, yeah. What else? Anybody else?
Apprehension.
What? Apprehension, yeah. Like, I don't want to go near that, yeah.
Shame,
yeah. Yeah.
Anger,
yeah. Yeah, that's normal. That's the impact of broken relationships. Unreconciled broken relationships can be like the experience of living with the dead. And by that, I mean that the relationship is over, but the person walks the earth. And that's very hard to cope with. That maybe they're even in your town, but your relationship to them is not the same. So we need wisdom in how to think about these things. And I need to name, too, that having wisdom on it doesn't mean we're going to get it fixed. No guarantees. But we're going to look at a few things that show up in these Proverbs, why we need reconciliation, like what causes the problem in the first place, why it eludes us, and we're going to look at some of what God is doing about it. So why do we need it? I'm going to march through most of these Proverbs here in a bit of a hurry. Proverbs 10:12 said, "Hatred stirs up quarrels, but love makes up for all offenses." We need reconciliation because instead of loving others, we hate people. Now, I know most of you, and I don't think you're particularly hateful people, right? Most of you didn't walk in the door cursing the name of anybody today. And I guess it all depends on what we mean by hate. You know, we tend to think of hate crimes. We think of the KKK on the march. And I don't think any of you are doing that. And if you are, we need to talk, okay? But I want us to consider the range of meaning for the word hate. And I want to present you as somebody in the Bible who was hated. And his name is Joseph. And there it is. Okay. Joseph, his brothers hated him. Why'd they hate him? Well, the presenting issue is they were jealous of his coat. And they were jealous of what his coat meant. They were jealous of how his coat meant that his father loved him very much and was very close to him and in a way treated him in a way that was preferential. And they became bitter about that and they dwelt on it and they began to talk about it amongst themselves. And Proverbs 10:12 is a parallelism. We've talked about parallelisms before here in our wisdom series, which means the second line explains the first. So the second line in Proverbs 10:12 is that love makes up for or covers over all offenses. So then hatred must be the opposite of that, which would be to expose offenses, express offenses. Perhaps the word gossip would be apropos. And we gossip. We gossip when we say things like, "Did you hear how they're doing?" When it's not just about getting support for them, but about getting somebody read in on their situation. When we give a report about a person or an opinion that we would not share with the person in the same way. If you said to Cruz the last time he preached, "Wow, I could tell you put a lot of work into that sermon, Cruz. Thank you very much." And then you came over to me and said, hey, that was a kind of a rough sermon. Are you going to talk to him? That is gossip because you didn't say the truth to Cruz. You brought me a different report than you were willing to give to him. The most sneaky method of this in the church is the prayer request. And I thought, oh, maybe I'm just like grumpy about church because I'm a pastor, you know. But then 2 days ago, I was reading Keller's Proverbs devotion, and he said the same thing. He said, how often do we gossip in the prayer request? And I was like, okay, Tim Keller says so. But you know, when you bring it up or you text somebody and, you know, I'm just really concerned for Pam these days. You know, we got to pray for her. Oh, why? Oh, you didn't hear. You know, I just really need you to pray for my family right now, when the intent of it is, I want you to know I'm not doing well, but it's veiled as a kind of an act of our faith. And how often that concern then gets out into the rumor mill, right? And gets discussed and remembered and ruminated on and brought back up and shared with some more folks. And metastasizes until a whole bunch of people are looking at each other sideways instead of walking with each other, right? 13:10 says our conflicts come from pride. Pride leads to conflict, but those who take advice are wise. Is pride reserved for presidents and movie stars, right? This is another parallelism. The opposite of pride is taking advice. Are any of us a bit slow to hear and receive advice? I would have no idea about this. I haven't faced it today, perhaps right before leaving the house. Wink, wink to my wife. You know, leaders of organizations and churches are known for being very compliant and quick to listen, you know, not very sure of themselves. So I wouldn't know anything about that, but maybe you do. Maybe you know a little bit about not hearing others' advice. We need reconciliation because we harbor hatred and we think we know what's best. 14:9-10 goes on to say, fools make fun of guilt, but the godly acknowledge it and seek reconciliation. And we don't think actually make fun of is probably the right word. It's probably more like make light of their guilt, as in saying my guilt is not as bad as their guilt. If you've ever had the sentiment, well, sure, I didn't handle that situation perfectly, but considering how they were responding, how could I? That's to make light of our guilt. And that's a relatable sentiment I have felt many times. 17:9 says, love prospers when a fault is forgiven, but dwelling on it separates close friends. That's a good addition to the previous thought, because while we're prone to discount our own guilt, we will dwell on somebody else's, especially if that person has a big role in our life, right? When I think of the word dwell, I think of like settle down on it, build a house on it, and spend all my time in that house thinking about it. You might say things like, I will never be like my father. Becomes a defining principle of your life. You're dwelling on it. I'm so glad, despite my issues, I'm not like Fred. And right when I wrote that, I thought, I haven't met a new Fred in a long time. When's the last time you met a Fred? It's been a while. Yeah, so nobody's in danger in here, I don't think, of being called out with the name Fred. But you go through the day thinking about how much they've made you miserable and just how sad that all really is and how they are like that is just so pathetic, and how great it is to not be them. What's dwelling on it? And commonly the question in response to something like that is like, well, you know, I would forgive them or, you know, whatever, but it takes two to tango. Or if you're cheesy, you say, what about them? You know, like, why do I have to be the one that forgives them, right? And my favorite answer on that comes from a marriage book. It's not my top marriage book, but it's called Love and Respect. And the author, Emerson Eggerichs, has a thing he calls the crazy cycle, which is where you know, he says that if the husband doesn't show love and the wife doesn't respect, I tend to think they both could do it. It doesn't have to be just one on one side of that equation or the other. But whatever the case, he says, when they're not doing that toward each other, they get in this cycle of just offending each other back and forth, and it doesn't stop. And he said, couples always come to him and they say, but why do I have to be the one to stop? What about them? Who stops it? And his answer is, whoever's most mature. Would either of you like to start the healing process? Yeah. Proverbs 23 said, avoiding a fight is a mark of honor. Only fools insist on quarreling. And by insist, this is kind of the opposite of being slow to anger. And it tends to go something like this. I just have to get my thoughts out. I need to express myself, as opposed to allowing time to consider how those words are going to land. Saying, I just need to get it off my chest, right? Proverbs 28:13-14, people who conceal their sins will not prosper, but if they confess and turn from them, they'll receive mercy. Blessed are those who fear to do wrong, but the stubborn are headed for serious trouble. And this talks about hiding the truth, right? Hiding who we really are. And the translators are a little shy here because it says they're headed for serious trouble, but in the Hebrew, it's actually they're headed for death. That's what it says. They're headed for death. And as we talked about with the kids, everybody's going to die. But if you have cancer and you deny that you have it, the death will come sooner and with less treatment. If you're harboring sin in your heart and you hide it, you will be rotting from the inside out like a cancer in your soul. 28:25 says, greed causes fighting. Trusting the Lord leads to prosperity. And greed here isn't just, you know, billionaire status. The commentator we're reading the most, Van Leeuwen, says, greed is looking at another person's little kingdom and saying, that's a nice kingdom. I wish it was mine. In fact, it should be mine. That's all it takes. I was surprised a couple weeks ago when I was in Louisville, which I'm still trying to learn how to say. I think it's Louisville. Isn't it pretty? That's the Abbey of Gethsemane where I got to hang out, and I got to hang out with these fine gentlemen right there. And, when I was there, we were talking about planning silent retreats. We were getting some training and brainstorming on silent retreats. And we had this short one day of our own silent retreat. And I kind of thought, when I've done silent retreats, it's been 2-3 days. So it usually takes me a little while to really like enter into that time and that space. And so I thought I probably won't have any kind of epiphany here. It's too short. But we had pre-read on a topic, and I chose the topic of beauty. And I'd been assigned some readings by the old monk Thomas Merton, who lived at that abbey, on the beauty of the Lord. And Thomas Merton had an experience in downtown Louisville one day where he was there. He's used to being at the Abbey, and he's around this crowd of people, and he is just struck by the people and how much love he was feeling for them for some reason. And he goes on in his writings to say, the more steeped you are in Scripture and the more you understand the Creator's heart for his creation, the more you will love the Creator through the creation. And he had that kind of experience thinking about people. And you can go down to where he was standing when he thought that. And my buddy Kevin on the side there was very disappointed that there was a giant trash can right in front of the memorial. But I was thinking about that, and I was reading about that and thinking, you know, you really do only see, we don't see God, but we see everything God has made, and we see God revealed through the things that he's made, and that, and potentially even people. So on the retreat is this other leader who I really love, great guy. But if I'm totally honest, I'm entirely jealous of him, like so jealous. If he were here, I would choose him to be your pastor, and I would recommend that you choose him to be your pastor instead of me. I would command you to do it, in fact. I mean, because this dude, he remembers every single thing he's ever seen. And then when he talks about all the things he remembers, it's with passion and conviction, but not in a way that feels overconfident, which annoys me. He carries himself so calmly, like it just dawned on him recently. And you're just getting let in to the amazing little thought he just had, but it doesn't feel like he's showing off, which is hard to do. You know, there's a line where somebody is fake and cheesy and nice and it feels weird. And this guy comes right to that line and he stops and he hugs people. And when he hugs you, he squeezes just right. Not too much. It's not uncomfortable, but it's enough to know he means it. And it's special. And it's like perfect. It's all perfect with this guy. And I wish that I was like him and that you had a pastor like that. So much so that I start disliking things about me, right? The way that I can stammer around when I'm trying to say something serious and that I get kind of like in my head where I can't just be clear because everything's nuanced with me. And so I start thinking about all this stuff when I'm around him, right? About how just like amazing he is and how disappointing I am, right? And it's weird. So I'm sitting out in the garden of the Abbey, and I'm sitting there with my notepad, and I'm thinking about all this, and I'm like, why do I think about him so much, you know, in general? Like this, what is going on? And then it dawned on me, I'm just jealous. I'm just super, super jealous. I want to be different, right? And that's the version I think would be ideal. And I thought about everything I'd been reading, and I was like, I should probably see the beauty of the Lord in him instead of being jealous. So I did a weird thing I've never done in my life. I wrote an entire page thank you letter to God for another man in a garden. I did that from Louisville, Kentucky. And it was awesome because it felt like I found something, like the jealousy got driven out because I just said, God, he is great to be around and he remembers things and he makes them meaningful and it's really cool to see. Instead of thinking about how I stink and I'm not him. I would recommend doing something like that with somebody you're jealous of. But this proverb says greed, which is a form of jealousy, right? It's destroying us, but trusting the Lord leads to prosperity, which means the word for prosperity does not mean, you know, private jets and all that. It's the feeling of being well-fed, just well-fed. Like you aren't hungry anymore. Because jealousy is this insatiable hunger. It feels like it's telling you what you need and you're never going to get it, but it's a lie. And it's actually starving your soul. But trusting the Lord, in my case, trusting that he's made me the person he wants me to be, right, led to a moment of feeling gratitude for the gifts that came through another person. So I've now applied that to 1 out of 5,000 relationships in my life. So I'm off to a start, and you can join with me. But I'm here to bear testimony that jealousy was eating away at my soul. So why do we need reconciliation? Because these are things that aren't just pitfalls. They're constantly drawing us in. Like as I listed all those things from the Proverbs, I know for me, it was like, I'm convicted by every single one of these. And what it does is it's satanic. And what I mean by that is, you know, the idea of Satan is an accuser of the brethren. And so when I start to look at other people and out of my jealousy, greed, hatred, whatever, I say like, they stink. I'm on the road to being unreconciled, even if nobody knows it. So it eludes us. That's my second idea. Reconciliation eludes us. Sometimes it doesn't happen, or it doesn't happen the way we'd like it to, or on the timeline we'd like it to. And probably many of the memories that bubbled up for you are around those kind of things. And the Proverbs give us a few insights on why it's so doggone hard to do. 26:20-26 read, fire goes out without wood and quarrels disappear when gossip stops. A quarrelsome person starts fights as easily as hot embers light charcoal or fire lights wood. Rumors are dainty morsels that sink down into one's heart. Smooth words may hide a wicked heart, just as a pretty glaze covers a clay pot. People may cover their hatred with pleasant words, but they're deceiving you. They pretend to be kind, but don't believe them. Their hearts are full of many evils. While their hatred may be concealed by trickery, their wrongdoing will be exposed in public. So there's a number of things here. But the first one, rumors are dainty morsels that sink into the heart. That's an interesting piece. The Hebrew seems to hint at the idea that we might call junk food. Junk food. So I know few people who believe that the big arch meal that's just been released is something healthy to eat, even though, see how deceptive? The little seeds on the bun? Doesn't that make you think, you're like, this is multigrain. Little seeds on there. It's pretty good for you, right? It's got lettuce. I mean, it's the equivalent of water, but it's good for you, right? Why is it that we prefer, though, unhealthy things to healthy things, especially when we get in the habit of it? Especially when we get in the habit of it. The proverb says that rumors are like dainty morsels, and it's like junk food. Think of that bowl of candy on the table. When you go over to somebody's house, the cursed bowl of candy. I just thought, Angie, you always have bowls of candy, and it's so hospitable. It's so hospitable. But what do I do, right? I'll just take like five. That wasn't much. I'll take like five. We're watching TV. I'll take like 10. You know, I just use the restroom, pass by the bowl. I'll take about 20 more. And all of a sudden, you know, you never would have eaten 10 bags of M&Ms, right? That would have felt ridiculous. But when there's a bowl and you're sitting in front of a bowl having five at a time, you know, you eat the dainty morsels and they sink down and they spike your blood sugar and they inflame and swell you from the inside. They damage the balance of bacteria in your gut. They flood you with calories without fiber, vitamins, minerals, or the healthy fats that you need. And the unhealthy fat globs onto your organs and blood vessels, making it difficult for them to function. Any medical people need to fix that? Is that okay? Celeste is like, it's so far gone that I'm not even going to try. But we like it, right? Because it tastes good and it's kind of addictive. And we do not feel that way about raw carrots and salmon. What? Right? Some people feel that way about salmon. Good for you. I like salmon, but I don't eat handfuls of it, right? So it is with jealousy, malice, and gossip that break down the body of communities, families, the body of Christ. It feels good and cathartic, like what we need to cope, but it's rotting us away. And it's so unfair because it's so tasty, right? So then the other piece in the proverb, of course, is that we aren't always aware of what's going on. The glaze on the pot, right? Because a person can glaze their pot. You can't always see the motives of another person. So sometimes when you're actually entering into quarrels and division, what it feels like is you're being trusted and being invited into the inner circle. And it feels really good because you don't know that what the person's trying to do is break things. It doesn't feel that way. The proverb suggests that we have to embrace a healthy dose of skepticism because people tend to eat junk food and move in the wrong direction. So what do we do with our skepticism? The proverb suggests that at some point, the person who's hiding that they are being quarrelsome and causing division will expose themselves. And it pretty much just says, it doesn't say you must stop them. You need to out them. Your job, it seems, is to just refuse to participate and let them expose themselves. But that can make it difficult because damage can be done. And then what? What do you do when someone's known as a divisive person? How do you reconcile with them? Isn't it ideal that everyone gets redeemed and reconciled? Wouldn't that be great? It is ideal. But it's not something we can force. And it often takes time and involves a process, and sometimes a painful process. So it can't be simply tolerated because it can destroy communities. And right now, I'm not even talking about when people are in danger or unsafe. That's just, let's just put that out. If you're in danger, don't just go be safe, right? I'm just talking about divisiveness. It can destroy communities. There are a couple proverbs that use humor to describe this. So let's see. Better a dry crust eaten in peace than a house filled with feasting and conflict. I can't see these. So let's see. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Better to live alone in the corner of an attic than with a quarrelsome wife in a lovely home. I heard the laughter when these came across earlier. And a quarrelsome wife is as annoying as a constant dripping on a rainy day. These are supposed to be funny. Ladies are like, I don't think those are so funny. Here's why they're supposed to be funny. Important note. The Proverbs don't just aim this at women. The first one, the dry crust, is all dudes assumed in that one, first of all. Number two, this book is framed as written from a king to his son. So there's a little more examples of the wife. But you have to take the book, as since it's written from a king to his son, ladies, you have permission to say, if this was written from a queen to her daughter, the subject of it would be husbands, okay? You can do that. That's fair. It's wisdom literature. That's what you do with it. So, you're supposed to be using humor to show that community is destroyed and what would be better. So, if you lived in the ancient Near East with a thatched roof, and the rain is dripping through your thatched roof, I mean, what you're aware of is like, why is my roof here? So that doesn't happen, right? So that it doesn't rain. And when it's raining on your thatched roof, you cannot fix it. You just can't get up there and fix it right now. You just have to deal with it. And it's really frustrating. So basically, this is saying you're dealing with like an unsolvable problem. You're in your house where you're supposed to be safe from the storm, but instead, you're still getting wet and you're also getting frustrated. It's worse than if you were just outside. Okay? That's the feeling. Conflict is like that. Being in conflict is worse than if you just weren't in the relationship at all. Right? The other roof one is more of a pun. The attic is not the right word. They did not have attics at this time. It's probably more like sitting on the very edge of your flat roof. And essentially what this one is saying is, during a storm, think about a monsoon. It's like there are two possible storms, the one that could happen outside your house and inside. And the one outside is easier to deal with. Like, it'd be easier to get just torrential rain and wind than to be inside of the house and deal with the conflict storm inside. It's like saying a similar thing. And then the bread. Think of a king saying to this son, and when they had a feast, it was a religious or political event, often both. And so he's basically saying, look, son, it would be better for you to be so poor that you were eating your bread bone dry without even olive oil, which was like, that was like your basic thing that you would put, you dip your bread into. It would be better to do that than to be at the correspondence dinner, right? Or to be like in the seat of power and have a bunch of conflict around you. That's a pretty stark statement, right? It'd be better to be so poor you didn't have olive oil. So all of these are saying conflictual relationships, terrible. It'd be better if you had a worse situation in your, you know, it'd be better to be outside in a storm. It'd be better to be poor. So what do you do about it? You've got three options, right? The first is to work it out. We read in 18:9, an offended friend is harder to win back than a fortified city. Arguments separate friends like a gate with bars. I think that's supposed to be essentially the advice that you would hear. Think about it before you burn your bridges, right? Before you burn your bridges, think about it. Like, if you offend this person, like, that relationship is going to be maybe impossible to restore. So before you go and do it, think about it. Is that really what I want for the rest of my life? That's one thing to do. Proverbs 22:24-25 gives another ideal, which is this: don't befriend angry people or associate with hot-tempered people, or you'll learn to be like them and endanger your soul, which is effectively stay out of those relationships in the first place, right? Like, here's the classic. I get this at church all the time. Somebody shows up at a church. What's their experience? My last church stinks. All the people stink. The leadership stinks. Okay, what am I thinking? Huh. You might think that about me in about 2 weeks, right? Like, maybe if that's what you're leading with, maybe it's you. Okay, the friendship version of that. Everybody else stinks, right? They're staying out. My other friends, all my friends left me. They're all terrible. You should think about that. Maybe that's a pattern. So maybe don't get into the relationship or go real slow. Okay? So there's that. But you can't always see it coming. We can grow in discernment. So 22:10 says, throw out the mocker. And fighting goes too, and insults and quarrels will disappear. Throw them out. Yeah, that happens. It happens in friendships. Interestingly, you know where we hear this the most in the Bible is in the New Testament about the church. Get them out of the community. They're causing division. And that's hard. Like, it's actually very standard in ancient Israel that even within, like, a judge's jurisdiction, a jurisdiction in one of their towns, if somebody was causing conflict, they just made them leave. It's actually a common practice that feels like, well, now with all our private property law, you can't do that to your neighbor, right? I can't go to my neighbor and be like, leave. You know, you're a jerk, leave. I can't. But there's some communities where you can. So how does that square with the ideal of reconciliation? Wouldn't it be best to win them over and fix it? Yeah, it'd be best. But you can't always do it. Some things you cannot leave unresolved, or it just continues to metastasize and spread and disrupt other people. These days, we call it being toxic, right? That's the word we have for it, right? Which gives you the sense of, like, I think of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I think of a person that's just, like, glowing. They're like, and, like, their toxicity is just getting all over everything, right? But that begs the question, right? Is just the one person toxic? Or am I? Do I bring anything to the story? It makes you think about that, doesn't it? And even more complicated is when you're a third party watching people that should be reconciled. And you're like, yeah, they both have their issues, but they should be able to work this out. I don't think either of them are that bad. I think they could figure this out, but they can't. And that is so frustrating, right? And demoralizing, because you think it doesn't have to be like this. For everybody's sake, it could be better. I mean, in churches, it's like for the sake of the faith, right? And for those situations, I think Proverbs 14:10 is particularly appropriate. It opens with the ideal that the godly acknowledge guilt and seek reconciliation. But then verse 10 adds this: each heart knows its own bitterness, and no one can fully share its joy. That's such an incisive little true statement. And I want to increasingly keep this in mind when I don't get another person's response to me, or I don't get their response to somebody else, because I wish people would give me the benefit of believing, they don't know what it's like to be me. Right? See, every time there's a conflict or a schism or irreconciliation, you're not dealing with a simple person, but a complex one. The situation that happened didn't just happen on an island, right? It gets mixed together with the person's whole story, their genealogy, their mental and physical capacity, and the life situations they're facing right now. And some of those things make it really tough to process what you're going through. And everybody's got a different story, right? There's some things that, because of my story, I can get over in a month or in a day. There was an old neighbor of mine named Bud, and he would come over to the house and argue politics with my father for 3 hours a day, I swear. Maybe 1 hour. It felt like three. And my mom was just like, Bud, go home, you know? And he should have gone home. But the thing is, like, my whole life, that was just mostly like funny. Like, my dad would just sit out there and go, oh, wow, interesting perspective. Okay. And Bud would, blah, 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 blah. So when one of you is just like, you know, blah, 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 politics, I just think of Bud and laugh. I'll be fine. For somebody else, that experience could be terrible because it could be what their father did to their mother and would never shut up and it blew their whole family apart, right? Like, it is different. We have a different story. The situations can feel so convoluted and complicated and hit on such acute pain points that I know for me, certain situations where like irreconciliation is in play have taken me years to unravel in my mind because they're hitting on all these points, these soft spots in my story. So if that's what happens to me, how can I refuse to let other people have their own bitterness and their own story and extend them the same grace that they might need some time, right? We need to temper our demands on other people because we don't know what it's like to be them. So reconciliation eludes us because division has this fast food appeal, because division sometimes is actually protecting a community, at least for a while, and because we don't know the inner hurdles that other people are dealing with. So it's elusive. So what is God doing about it, finally? Unlike us, God knows the hearts of people. He knows what reconciliation will take. He knows how to get it done. One of the great stories of reconciliation is Joseph in Genesis that I mentioned earlier. In fact, it's an early sneak peek, I think, of the story of the whole Bible. I have this little theory, and I think it's true, that if you stretch the book of Genesis across the whole storyline of the Bible, the themes match up almost perfectly. So why do I say that? Because Joseph, in the story, he's part of God's chosen people, right? He is the favored son who his father Jacob loves. And his brothers, rather than being thankful for him and rather than writing a letter to God to say, you know what, Joseph's amazing, thank you for him, thank you for how he wears that coat, he looks so good in that coat. They don't do that, right? They want what he has, they talk, they conspire, they betray him, they assault him, they leave him for dead, they strip him of his garments. He's as good as dead, but he lives, right? Even though his father sees his garment, as in this artistic rendition, and believes that he has lost his son. He lives in the heart of the ungodly empire of Egypt, and after he suffers there for a time, he's exalted to the right hand of power, and when famine comes, the nations all of a sudden are subjected under his feet, where he can dole out salvation to all those who will humble themselves before him. And when his brothers come desperate for salvation, he's moved with love and mercy towards them, and he declares that what they meant for evil, that God had intended for good and for their redemption. And so they are in many ways saved by grace, which is the undeserved favor of God, stewarded through the beloved son, Joseph. Does that sound familiar? People who've been around Christianity? Because the Bible follows the same arc, but it provides a son, a savior who's greater than Joseph, not just the favored son of Jacob, but the son of God, who didn't enter the empire, but entered the depths of death itself, whose exaltation was not just at the right hand of Pharaoh, but as we talked about with the kids, to the right hand of God over all kingdoms on earth and in spiritual realms. So the reconciling that he can bring covers any offense for those who would receive him as Lord and Savior. And of course, we're talking about Jesus. Now, I want us to try for a second an experiment. So remember that person or situation from earlier in the sermon that I said you could think about. You can think about it again, okay? Michaela and I heard a podcast that gave us this little exercise, and I think it's pretty powerful. It's simple. I just want you to take a moment, and you don't need to imagine how this would happen. It doesn't need to be feasible. But I want you to imagine one thing. If reconciliation happened in that story, what would it look like? Let it play out like a movie in your head for 30 seconds. Now, what kind of feelings come from imagining that? You can name them. What kind of feelings come when you imagine that? Peter says peace, hope. Irritation. What's that?
Irritation.
Disappointment. Yeah.
Joy.
Yeah. Yeah. Those speak to what it would mean for that reconciliation to happen, right? Sometimes it's one we don't really want. If it's one that we do, even just imagining it can bring you the emotion you thought was inaccessible. The key to pursuing any kind of reconciliation is first to hold open that it's possible, allowing yourself to hope. And the good news of the Bible is that it is. And I don't mean that it is within your power. In fact, it's quite beyond our control to achieve it. It might be quite beyond the possibility that it would happen in our lifetime. But God can take, as in the story of Joseph, even things that were intended for evil and utilize them for good. And with that kind of hope, we can turn from our addiction to junk food, resentment, bitterness, hatred, to acting in love even to the undeserving. Proverbs 25:21-22 said this: if your enemies are hungry, give them food to eat. If they're thirsty, give them water to drink. You'll heap burning coals on their head. And I left out the word shame because it's not there in the Hebrew. That's an assumption in the text. Burning coals on your head, and the Lord will reward you. The translators choose shame because it could happen. Burning coals, of course. What would happen if I took my bonfire recently burned down and I threw that on your head? Burns would happen. You will experience some pain, right? And when you experience some pain like that, it can do a couple of things. In this case, I think what it means is that it can awaken somebody to the effects of their own behavior. So kindness to your enemy can make your enemy say, what have I done? Who am I that I don't respond in that way? It can have that effect. I don't know if that's shame. I like the idea of being awakened to something. Or you can throw them on there and the person can be mad, right? And I think that in this case, what it means is like, if you do the kind thing, the benevolent thing, even to an enemy, and they hate you for it, there's a window into their heart that both of you needed to see. But in either case, the calling here in the proverb, and not just in the proverb, Paul echoes it again in Romans 12:20. He says, he quotes this proverb and he follows it up by explaining why, not to be overcome by evil, but to overcome evil with good. The point of feeding your enemy, giving them food, giving them water, is to overcome evil with good, to inspire them to change. So we end by asking this question, how did Jesus reconcile? How did he reconcile people? Did he, so he walks with his cross up to Golgotha, and they put the cross there, and he stands and he says, now I want a real good apology. And you better know exactly what you did to God, or I'm not going up there. No, that didn't happen. That did not happen. Did he walk up there and the cross is placed there and he goes, now some of you, I can tell you feel real bad. I'm going to do this for you because you feel so crummy. But those of you who don't get it, oh boy, you're going to get the smackdown. No, that did not happen either, right? What he does is he says, Father, forgive them to everybody. They don't know what they're doing. It's on offer to his enemies, right? And they get to grapple with what they're going to do with that thing that he's just given them, the thing that he's offered. Jesus bore a great cost that we might be reconciled to God and others. The question for us as Christians is, what do we do with the coals on our head? He poured them on our head. What do we do? Will we offer that to anybody? Or will we remain unmoved, demanding from people what we cannot achieve ourselves? And that might be the test of the heart that we need to look at the most. We'll move into our three final rhythms of worship, which are confess, receive, and offer. Confession for us is a two-minute silence, and I'm going to suggest a specific theme here, which is to keep that person in mind, right? And to ask God, what would it look like to love my enemy? And tell God all the reasons you don't want to do it. God's there for it. He's not judging you. Confess. Receive. Our primary method of reception here is to take the Lord's Supper, in which we encounter Jesus, right? And we encounter him in his moment of sacrifice and suffering. And we encounter him in the moment he's reconciling all things to himself. And at the table, with his betrayer present, with disciples who are going to run away and leave him and abandon him and fail him, disciples who are sideways with each other, who are jealous of each other, all that kind of stuff, Jesus takes the bread and he says, this is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of this, remember me. And he's not just saying, like, remember me, like, keep me in mind. He's saying, remember what I do. Remember who I am. And follow me. Right? He takes the cup from the table. This is the blood of a new promise in my blood. Whoever drinks of it remembers me. I promise you, I will not drink of it again until We are together in my Father's kingdom. And this is a statement of radical forgiveness at a great cost. And as that bread dips in, as you taste it, what that's supposed to mean to each one of us is it was really costly to reconcile me to God. Really, really costly. And that's not to make you feel guilty. It's just true. And it's a method of sending you into the world. If you follow Jesus, if you're his people, you were bought at a great cost. We must offer what we've been given, which leads to offer. We have a table back there. We have the all-important monetary giving that's very important to us. But at the same time, the window is back there where we name something. Today, I'd like to suggest that you put two words up there. And don't worry about writing on top of people. That's the point. It's going to be a beautiful mess when it's done. Two words. God is calling me to move from this to this. Jealousy to gratitude. Gossip to restraint. Things like that. To follow Jesus in this area, I need to move from here to here. And just, you don't have to, know you're going to do it. Just name it. And don't put your name on it. It doesn't matter. Name it for you to remember. I'm going to pray for us. There will be 2 minutes of silent confession. And then after that, Jules will begin to play, Jules and Josh. And we will partake of the Lord's Supper before dinner, which is Sonoran Dogs. So let's pray. Father, I did not enjoy thinking through this sermon myself, and I could imagine some of us are troubled within because these stories are hard stories and they're hurtful, especially when they're about us, but even when they bring up our hopes and our desires, the way we wish things were different and better, but they're not right now. And we need hope, and we want to be the kind of people that follow you, but it feels really, really vulnerable to do that. Like we could get hurt. Jesus, I pray that you would help us to see that holding on to those things is what's killing us, and that you're offering us freedom, even if it's scary, and teach us to follow you. So lead us now as we pray.